It's over 100 degrees in a tomato field in the Central Valley of California, and harvest is underway. We're right where the action is, the working end of your future meals, with Fresno County tomato farmer Stuart Wolf, accompanied by the sounds of the field. Listen and remember this conversation when you're enjoying the flavor of summer in tomato products at home or your favorite restaurants throughout the year.
So I'm talking to Stuart Wolf. Stuart, we're standing in a tomato field and a harvester has just gone by us. How is it different out here in the field of the harvesting going on of processed tomatoes as what it was recently? You made some changes in your operation.
Well, what I'd like to do is tell you the way it was when my dad started.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, so when dad started, this was all furrow irrigated tomato fields on 60-inch beds. And so every row, there'd be water going down the row, and we would saturate the beds. And a lot of the tomatoes, because of all the moisture, they would mold, and we'd have all kinds of issues. And in those years, he was averaging like 20 ton to the acre, 20 to 25 ton. That was back in the early 70s. Today, on the same land, we now have berry drip on beds that are much larger. And they're 80-inch beds, not 60s. And we can actually, with berry drip, grow a much bigger vine. All the tomatoes are dry. These are hybrid varieties, and they're non-GMO, but we get much more production. So this field right now, we're averaging over 60 ton to the acre.
60 tons. So compared to your dad's time, what did it start out as?
Yeah, so we're close to three times what dad was doing on the same land. But the other thing, this harvester that just went through, the harvesters that he used in his day, we had about 20 people on a machine that was sorting. This machine that just went by had two, and really we could get by with zero. But we have people on there to pick out foreign material, should it get it in the machine and what have you. Nevertheless, today with this dry bed, and after we've just shredded the plant out of the back of the harvester, we can skip about four or five different tractor passes to get this field ready for the next crop. So years ago, when there would be a dried vine left in the field, we would have to disc it several times. Because it was furrow irrigated, we would do some deep ripping. Because we were furrow irrigating, we'd do some land planing. And then we would reshape the beds for the next crop. Right now, this bed, we'll come back in here with a mulcher, keep the bed in its original shape. It's dry. We'll just mulch all this organic material back into the ground. And this will be a one-pass operation, where years ago we would have been doing five or six passes when we were furrow irrigating.
And all of that would take somebody to run the equipment, but also you'd have to put gas or diesel in the tractors, and you're eliminating that right now. And I would think, too, with all of that disking and turning the ground, you'd have soil blown away a lot more than you do with leaving this much cover in it.
Yeah, you know, we wouldn't be out here working if it was crazy windy or whatever, but you're absolutely right. So we're tilling the ground a lot less. We're using less diesel. This requires less water. It requires less fertilizer. It requires less of everything. And so we really are producing more with less.
You mentioned berry drip, and so it's drip irrigation. Most people understand that.
Yeah.
And these are would be like almost like spaghetti straws coming off of some of these of the hoses. How deep is the drip beneath the ground?
Yeah, so we're down, you know, approximately about a foot with a plastic hose that has little tiny holes in it, emitters, and basically this ground subs very well. So when you put water on it, the water moves laterally as well as going down. So once we get the plant going and it starts growing, and we put water in that hose underneath the ground, those roots will hit that moisture, and the roots will grow wherever the moisture is. So we can keep a ball of moisture, if you will, just below the plant and not have to irrigate and have a lot of deep moisture, which is what my father used to do in the past.
So you're bringing this equipment in, though. You're able to stay above the drip lines and still work the soil a little bit, but not be disruptive of that berry drip.
Well, that's right. So we know that the drip hose is right in the the middle of this 80-inch bed, and we're going to maintain these beds. But all of the drip hose and all the work that goes here, this is all GPS-guided equipment and tractors, so we know exactly where it is.
So when he's driving these tractors through, he's connected with a satellite somewhere that's keeping him on track, and it's amazing. Now, with the buried drip too, how about the nutrients that you feed? So you're able to add nitrogen?
Yeah. So we can add any materials that we want to add to the plant. We can just put it directly into the root zone.
So liquefied.
Yeah. It's all liquid. And so, again, if we went back to like my father's day where he was furrow irrigating, you had to put enough water down the furrows so the water would sub across the beds and get to the roots. And if you were running fertilizer in those water runs, you know, a lot of it just was going beyond the roots or getting past it and everything. But with today's high cost of fertilizer and everything, we can just mainline it directly to the root zone here, and it's a vastly more efficient way to distribute and deliver fertilizer to these plants.
So like how much more efficient? Like nitrogen use, how much more efficient is this approach than the way you used to put nitrogen in?
Yeah, when we go back and we look at my dad's records earlier on, he was actually pretty efficient in his day, and he was getting, you know, he'd be like 65-70% efficient with his nitrogen. And the way we would measure that, we would measure the nitrogen in the soil at the beginning of planting, and then we would figure out how much nitrogen the plant needed and we were putting on with our irrigation system. And then at the end of the harvest, we would check the soils again, and we would check the amount of nitrogen that actually came out in the crop. So all the crops that we're growing have nitrogen in them. And actually, the USDA has a schedule of crops and how much nitrogen's in there. So with those benchmarks, you could determine how efficient. Today, our nitrogen use efficiency, some of my fellow growers say we're actually mining the nitrogen out of the soil, like we're not putting enough through the lines, because, you know, we're doing the same steps. We're measuring the nitrogen at the beginning, what the plant requirements are, and our crop yields are so great now that there's more nitrogen that's coming, you know, out with the crop that, you know, we're right now, on average, we're probably 95 to 100% efficient on nitrogen use. And again, that's the nitrogen applied to the amount that's required and used by the plant to grow the crop and what's in the crop.
So you don't have to worry then about nitrogen, leaching, getting into the ground, the groundwater.
No, we don't. You know, the great thing about drip is you're not leaching down into the aquifer. Our aquifer here is about 275 to 300 feet deep. And we've got this little hose right at the top of the ground that's delivering some material, and we're not applying enough water to leach it down anywhere. So here, it's fine. Our big challenge is with this system is if we have to rely on our groundwater that has more salts in it, we can actually get more salts. The salts are concentrating now just in that wetted area under the plant.
Here comes a tractor and some empty wagons. So if anybody doubted we're outstanding in your field, here we are. There he goes.
So this is one of the reasons, like, growers in our area are so anxious about our surface water supplies. Yeah, we make a point of not growing tomatoes back to back every year. At most 2 or 3 years in a system like this, you know, then we want to rotate it. There are growers that plant tomatoes in the state just year after year after year and been able to maintain their yields. But our farm management team here, they really want to rotate these crops.
So last year you had wheat. So explain a little bit about planting the tomatoes, because when did you plant them, and how do you plant the tomatoes in these fields?
So, you know, we have our own tomato processing plant, and we have a season of about 100 days where we're going to be receiving tomatoes and producing tomato paste. So we have annually we put together a crop map, and we plant these tomatoes in these varieties, and all these different varieties have a certain number of days before they actually come to maturity. So we try to match up our schedule to run our tomato plant so every day we can be harvesting tomatoes for about a 100-day period. So we spread our planting out throughout the season. Usually we'll start kind of, say around late January, early February, we're putting transplants in the ground, and then we get that berry drip going and get moisture to it, and we'll plant all the way through to about May to get our full length of season for our tomato processing plant.
So these transplants, then these were started as seeds in greenhouses,
yeah.
And then you purchase them,
yeah,
and plant them.
Right. And so you go out and you buy seed from companies like Heinz and others, and you get a unit of seed, which is about the size of a coffee bag. And that unit of seed, these are hybrid seeds. They've been cross-pollinated and everything using traditional breeding practices. But you can buy seeds that, 100,000 seeds is a unit, and that 100,000 seeds could cost $5,000-$6,000.
This coffee bag size?
The coffee bag size, yeah. But that one bag we can spread, over several acres. And it's pretty amazing. You think about that one little bag, and I'm saying we can spread it over a couple football fields. And the way we're doing it, we send the seed to a greenhouse. They germinate each one of those seeds, and we come up with these little plugs with tomato plants that we're putting in the field, spacing out as far as we can. And what's so amazing is the price of tomatoes really hasn't changed all that much over like a 20, 30 year period, but all of our inputs like seed, we used to buy seed for $30 a unit, and now we're paying $4,000-$6,000.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But what's the reason for that?
Well, better seed varieties. We've been able to improve our yields. There's a lot of, this is like creating, it's probably like the pharmaceutical industry. These guys breed a lot of seeds, but not all of them make it to market.
Sure.
So
sure.
It's an expensive proposition. And these tomatoes today have better attributes and flavors and what have you than they've ever had before.
So you get these tomatoes plants in the ground. Again, we're standing in the field and watching them being harvested. You got them in the ground. You've got the water. You're able to fertilize them. And between then and now, what do you have to do as far as pesticides or fungicides, or what are the kind of products that you need to be applying to deal with diseases or insects?
Yeah, so we have some insects that really kind of raise hell with us. And those generally, we're working with, clearly we put out beneficial insects. We'll put out pheromones where the...
You've got beneficial insects in these tomatoes?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Well, we've got ladybugs out here. There's spiders. There's all kinds of stuff in here. And
must be another little bag.
And so, nobody wants to come out here and like do the scorched earth thing, because you basically, you got a battle going on out here. You want to support the right team,
right?
So, we go after the insects that are real problems for us, and then so that's mostly what we do. We're in a very arid region here, and we're on berry drip, so we don't have to rely on fungicides. You use fungicides in areas where you have problems with lots of moisture.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you look at other regions of the state where they have a lot more rain and it, comes with greater frequency, generally you'll find more fungicides. In this area, if you have proper crop rotation, you can handle a lot of the soil-borne diseases. We can manage our insect pressure.
Now we get to have a jet going.
And now we have a jet going.
It's not your jet. This is.
And and really we don't use a lot in fungicides. So this is one reason Fresno County is the most productive tomato growing region in California, or for that matter, the world. This one county, Roger, will be growing more tomatoes annually, about the same amount as Italy. And this is just one county.
So anybody in the country that's enjoying tomato sauce, ketchup, and salsa, pretty likely some of it came from your farm.
Well, I don't know about our farm, but certainly this county.
Yeah.
I would say this, if you're having, if you're using ketchup or, yeah, some spaghetti sauce or whatever, there's a pretty good chance that we grew some of the tomatoes. Certainly, this county represents right now about a third to almost 40% of the state's production comes from this region. So
Is 90% of the nation's production.
Which is, I think 92%, yeah. I think, is right. And we're about a third of global production, the state is. So chances are, you've certainly, if you're eating any kind of pizza or whatever, you're probably having some California tomatoes in there.
Well, speaking of pizza, as I understand it, the tomatoes that we're standing in the field today are going to leave the field. They're going to a processing plant, and they're going to get cleaned and possibly been put into paste.
Yeah.
And going to somebody that makes pasta sauces and distributes them all over the United States. So this particular field probably is going to end up in some sort of pizza sauce. Pasta sauce of some sort.
This is going to a friendly competitor of ours that we grow for, and our factory only produces tomato paste. His factory produces a lot of different sauces and whole peel diced products, and they are excellent tomato products. But it's basically for the food service trade. So if you're going into a high end Italian restaurant, these tomatoes are making that superior product.
Now, with these tomatoes, they being put on the truck and taken to your friendly competitor?
Yeah.
So they aren't going to go through the plant, really, other than to be transferred for a truck for the highway.
No, that's right. So they'll be trucked up further north of us. And, you know, you raise an interesting point. So, you know, 20-plus years ago when we built our tomato factory in the middle of all these tomato fields, we were able to take millions and millions of miles off the roads because we are simply taking them from these fields to that tomato plant just right over there that you can see. And it was one of the real kind of benefits, I think, that nobody really appreciates. We took a lot of truck miles off of these roads because prior to us building our own plant, all of our fruit got shipped to the north to facilities that were 70, 80, 90 miles away, and we were trucking stuff day and night, and today it's all right here.
Well, and when you talk about taking it off the road, some of it's going by rail, isn't it, to the east?
Yeah, ultimately, once it's processed and canned and everything, it goes out by rail and what have you. And we have a rail site here. So.
And when you're shipping paste that way, yes. You've actually taken water out, leave the water here, take it back there, and sometimes they add water back in. When they're
right.
at a spot that actually has more water, where they're, you know, have 40 inches of rain a year versus, what, a dozen? Yeah.
So these tomatoes are about 95% water. So we've used our irrigation water to grow this crop. We then take the tomatoes over to our plant. We pull the moisture out of it. We get it down. We end up producing water by pulling it out of these tomatoes, and we use that water again on other crops on the ranch. So we really are recycling all this stuff.
What a story. The next time that anybody that listens to this, I think, is pouring some ketchup on a hamburger or having some more pasta sauce or salsa, they ought to think back of what's behind it. And it's a great story, too. I mean, I'm what have we left out? Because we've talked a lot about the sustainability. You're producing more with less and making an excellent crop, keep making improvements. I mean, how far into the future can we keep making improvements? So is there anything left to do? What can you be optimistic about in the next few years when you compare it to the progress you made in the last few years?
I would only say this. You know, I look at my dad's budgets from 74. You know, my father was known as being a very, very good farmer, like a lot of his friends in the area. And if they were budgeting 20 and 25 tons, I'm sure they could have never imagined that you and I would be standing in a field looking at a harvester that's probably doing 60, 65. So, you know, I know in this field right now, even with the yields that we're getting, we're capturing so much more information today than we ever had before. So we're using like satellite data right now that can measure the evapotranspiration rates throughout this field. So, you know, you look across this field, it looks very uniform and everything. But there are pockets of this field that are doing probably 80 or 90 tons and other pockets that are doing 45, 50, 60 tons. And I think the trick's going to be for us to figure out how do we make it all 90. So I still think, you know, we're going to get smarter, we're going to get better, we're going to start using big data to, you know, capturing this stuff from satellites and infield sensors to really dial this thing in even more. And my guess is if you were to go forward another 10 or 15 years, we'll look back on this and kind of chuckle that we were talking about 60 ton out in the field.
Well, let's make a date right now. I'll meet you here, 10, 15 years from now, and get ready for a chuckle. So, Stuart Wolf, I really want to thank you for taking the time to explain this fascinating story and a story that's getting better every year.
Well, great. I love having you out here. I'm going to take you up on that date in 10 years.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.